So today I have a professional host at my side. So for this Friday postgame show, I don't have to do much because we have Francis Maxwell.
Professional host?
Yeah, that's what you do for a living. It's Malcolm, Steve, and I.
Did I graduate from the minor leagues?
Yeah.
You've been there
for a couple of years now.
You guys hold your own.
We hold our own because we're very down to earth. We're friendly with the audience, but we're a mess when it comes to being hosts. Hair, clothes. That. Phones.
Well, you got me on the operation. This is my casual day, and people still ask me why I'm dressed down, and I don't get it. It's just a shirt. This is just like, this is how you should dress normally every day.
This is an update for me, but see, this is nice. It's a good shirt.
Well, you know how much I love to chat with you, Dave. It reminds us of the early days when we used to talk on sports about some tennis.
Right.
We even did
golf once, even though I just faked it because it was Ryder Cup.
You fit right in. Yeah. So did I. That's what I would do with basketball and football and in that other sport, they hit with the bat.
Right. But the TYT members aren't here for sports. No. They're here for the random Friday grab bag. Mm-hmm. We have three subjects today. One is your trip to Uganda. Another is an obituary, classic Dave Kohler style. And the third is this profile of a Bolivian student at UCLA, which we'll get into. Mm. But the people on the TYT members who watch the show know that you went to Uganda because Steve talked about it. Is it Uganda or Uganda?
Uganda. Yeah, I never understand why, in the United States, you pronounce U's a little awkward sometimes, like Uruguay. Now, that might actually be I think that is the correct pronunciation.
That's Spanish.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
English.
So, when I first came here, I tried to be all smart and was like, what do you call it, the United States of America? And then I quickly was reminded in the comment section, you idiot, that's how you say it in Spanish.
Right.
But I think it's Uganda.
Uganda.
Yeah.
So you went to Uganda.
Yeah.
And the TYT members know that because Steve talked about it. There was a uncertainty about who was going to go. I think you were the lucky one who was selected.
Lucky one chosen. I don't know how much Steve was supposed to discuss it. Because there's been pretty firm restrictions being thrown my way as to the date that I can discuss. But I can talk about general topics until Tuesday is when the
But that's what I want to talk about, general topics. So stick around until Tuesday and you'll get the production that came out of it. But not too many people travel to Uganda. And those who do probably don't leave. They either go to the capital and a safari and then that's it.
That's it, yeah.
But you did a lot more. Where'd you go?
So the trip itself was insane to get there because I've never been to Africa. And I've been on a lot of flights, as you know, coming from Scotland. It's usually a 12-hour journey to London and then jump on a flight from London to Scotland. So I'm used to the long traveling. But I had to fly to Turkey. I was flew into Istanbul. And then from Istanbul, I flew into Rwanda. And you have to stop off in Rwanda to get into Uganda. I don't know if it's a legislation or there's something put in place, but you had to wait. And I just sit on the runway for 45 minutes and people got off and some people got back on. And then we flew from there into Entebbe, which is the main city in Uganda. And then from there, I had to wait for a few hours. And then I got on one of those tiny little planes where it's just one seat on each side.
Right.
Like a propeller plane that I've never been on in my life. And I flew from, which is in the city of Kampala, which is one of the most built up areas. And immediately before I got onto where I went, that straight from the get-go broke any stereotype that I had in my mind about Africa. Let's be honest, Africa's not painted in any sort of modern light or even fairly across the world. It's people just assume that it's poverty, it's war-torn, it's sand,
famine.
And dust. And then when you get the lighter side of it, it's safaris, like you mentioned. You can go and see great stuff. But when I was so amazed by how green it was when I was in Kampala. I was amazed by how there was a golf course right there outside the airport. And even just small things like that, I'd never heard of that. So it actually reminded me of a great article that I seen recently on the Huffington Post, which promotes a site that I'm going to tell people to go and check out, which is called Everyday Africa on Instagram. And it's images that are completely to just debunk stereotypes on Africa and promote the amazing things that you can do there, not just the safaris, but you can go whitewater rafting, you can go and check out the Nile. There's so many amazing things. So rather than getting into that.
Yeah, but that's not what you did.
That's not what I did. So I had a brief spell of how green it was in a built up industrial city. Now it still didn't look like New York or anything like that, but it was a lot more built up than I had imagined. And then I jumped on that tiny little plane, which was scary because you're just so used to going in turbo jets, it's shaking all over the place. And we flew into this small little town called Arua. And in Arua is home to many South Sudanese refugees who are fleeing South Sudan that, without going into detail of the project, people know South Sudan is a war-torn area at the moment. There's a huge tribal war going on. People are being slaughtered. It's a really awful situation. And Uganda are welcoming South Sudanese refugees. So what my project was to do was to just go and kind of find out what was going on and try to see how people are interacting in this community and kind of figure out how Uganda perceives refugees. And my findings, of course, will be displayed on Tuesday. But what I can say is that, as cliche as it sounds, it was just one of the most remarkable trips I've ever taken in my life.
Now, where did you sleep? Where did you sleep?
It wasn't pretty. I slept in a, it was a hotel. There was no power. There was no hot water. I had to shower with water bottles. I couldn't see in the middle of the night. And the bugs in Uganda are like on steroids, man. Like a story that I've told people recently, I told Jason on sports. One night, I tried to get everything done before I'd go to bed before the power went off. Because when the power goes off, it's just pitch black. You can't see nothing. So I tried to get everything done as quick as I could. No, didn't get it in time. So I still had to brush my teeth, still had to whatever. And it was pitch black. I could not see a thing. And the mosquito nets are everywhere. So you're basically climbing through an obstacle course to get to the bathroom. So like I just ended up, I lay down. It was so hot, man. It was crazy. So I ended up, I had to get back up to go use the restroom. I can't see anything. So usually I'd use my phone, but my phone was dead. So there was no power to charge it. So all the light I had is when your phone comes up and says that it needs to be charged. There's a tiny little light. That was all I had, right? So I was trying to navigate my way through my room. And I take one step out, Dave, and I kid you not, it sounded like I stepped on a car. Like it just crunched under my bare feet. Mm-hmm. And I hate bugs, so I freaked out. I had no idea. I thought I was going to have a panic attack. And I ended up, I never even went to the restroom. It just completely removed whatever need I had to go to the bathroom and went right back to my bed and just cowered there for hours. And then when the sun finally came up, I looked down and it was the biggest rain beetle I've ever seen in my life. It must have been about this size. That I had just crunched in the middle of the night when I went in.
How did it get in?
When I went into the room, it was like Jurassic Park, man. There was just spiders. And I'm not over exaggerating. Everyone that was with me was like, it's normal. Because people I was with, a couple of people I was with, they live in Kenya. They work in that area. So they work in Africa and they experience all the hardships. Now, I'm just going to openly admit, I don't go on these trips that often. The bugs in Scotland are not that big.
Right.
You just walk around with sheep and stuff like that. So, and I've never been in a situation where I couldn't see. So there was just bugs everywhere in my room. It was a really interesting situation. I had to stay in that place for 5 days because it was so close to the area that we were working out of. And because final reason why you had to live so close is the roads aren't roads. They're like all bumpy.
Yeah.
So it takes a trip for 2 miles takes at least 25 to 30 minutes because you can't drive fast.
Right.
There's just bumps everywhere on the road. You'll end up messing up the car. So you had to live relatively close. And that was my accommodation. But I mean, complaining about that after what I seen, I felt very pathetic.
Did you do anything just on your own or everything you did was for the project?
You weren't allowed to, and again, I didn't want to make it seem like you're just not advised to be walking around by yourself. Uh-huh. Something that I noticed immediately was that I was trying to find the words to say it. It's that when you're a white person in this area that where I was in, which was a poor area, is people often assume that you have money to give them.
Right.
And you have things to give them. So everywhere I walked, if I was out on barefoot or the people that was with me, and we were all just walking and not in a car, there was crowds of at least 100 to 150 people swarming us within 3 to 4 minutes. Just like trying to find out what was going on, being curious, looking for things, looking for food, looking. And that's the part of Africa that is true, that obviously many people think that's all of Africa, but no, when you go to these tough areas and a town that welcomes a lot of refugees that is poor in its own, there is a very, a hard way of life that goes around that people are needing more help. And oftentimes these people who are needing more help are often opening up their backyards to refugees and helping them. So the ideology of people there is so amazing. They're just they're happy people. Non-stop, like I never seen one kid crying. Mm-hmm. Like I never seen all kids that are running around in the street are just like happy, such an amazing outlook on life. And I guess they just didn't want us walking on their own in case you got lost or in case you had any difficult encounters.
Yeah, probably there was no problem walking on your own. They didn't want
the
responsibility.
Yeah. So that was kind
but of. But when you say you're walking and there might be a crowd of 100 swarming, are those refugees or residents of that
town?
Both.
Oftentimes we would go into refugees situations when we'd see refugees that were almost in better conditions than the Ugandan nationals mm-hmm. in an area. It was a poor area. So there was people just often looking, because the organization we were with, there's obviously this idea that they provide help. And people were looking for more help. They were looking for more food. They were looking for more water, more shelter to help. So it was an interest. I've never been in any experience like that. And it was just, I felt helpless at times. And there was a few times where I found it very tough and I couldn't, I think still to this day, I was only there for a week, but still I have like memories from it that I think I blocked out a little bit just to get through the week. Like you see some things that we won't be able to show them completely on camera, but there's some difficult situations that comes with a developing country helping out another developing country. There was a lot of amazing things that I took from it, but it was definitely difficult to see some of the things that I had to see and to be able to be looked upon as someone who can provide help, but not having the means to be able to help like a mass group of people.
And when we say refugee camp, when you say, I think of a prison camp, it's not a prison, obviously.
Yeah.
So what is it like? Is there a fence? Is there a gate?
The first thing that they mentioned is you cannot call it a refugee camp. Uh-huh. It's called a refugee settlement because they don't want it to be considered
good like, point.
Yeah, an area where people are just kind of put to be together.
Right. A couple
of points that I think I can mention at this point. It's whatever. We'll see what happens. But I think I can is that the government doesn't own the land that's in these communities. The people who live in the communities own the land, so they decide on how much land they can designate to refugees. Which I think is so outstanding. And was so evident as soon as I spoke to Ugandan nationals that they understand how tough these situations are. It wasn't too long ago that their country was in uprising, which was during a dictatorship. And they fled to Sudan to be helped. So a lot of these people understand that they can't turn away people and they need to try to work together to build a better community. And that was just, every time I talked to someone and I heard that, like I almost got chills, I was tearing up. I was thinking like, that's so opposite to what you hear a lot of the time in regards to refugees. So these settlements, they didn't look any different that much to me to their towns that they were in. Hmm. Like a lot of these houses are huts, they're built out of wood and there's a lot of farming going around and a lot of these refugees are given areas so that they can provide to themselves and provide like the basically what you're growing is what you're going to feed yourself. There's no like export, there's no trade that goes on. I think there's trade within the community, but it's not like if you give a refugee a land of 50 by 50 or whatever, that they're going to grow and suddenly they're going to benefit hugely by trading coffee with people or trading whatever. They make it for themselves and they often raise like goats to be able to, so they can eat and feed for their family. It's not like if you were to give someone a store in New York and all of a sudden they're going to make so much money from it and it's going to be detrimental to other people there. No, it's the way they look at it is we're here to help each other and if we can trade with each other, great. But they look to give them an environment that's safe. And from what I've seen, it didn't look too much different than the actual communities that we were in.
Hmm. So you talked about how green things were when you got to the big city. Was this area where you spent the week also green or is this
there was a
arid?
There was a lot of amazing scenery. I think we have, there was one photo that we can throw up that actually kind of shows a little bit how green it is, which is when I was at the border, which by the way, and so, well, this is a good one to have first. This is the most traditional photo you'd ever probably take from someone thinking they're going to Africa. It's, oh, I see an elephant. But what was amazing about this is this wasn't on a safari. This wasn't on like a paid adventure. Uh-huh. This was when I was on my way back to the airport at Arua. So because there's no flights, like consistently, our flight that we were supposed to get back out so that we could go to the capital and fly home was canceled. Hmm. So we had to drive 8 hours, and it would usually probably take like 2 or 3 hours if you were driving on roads here.
Yeah.
But it took us 8 hours, but the driver took us through a national park, and we were driving across this amazing bridge. Down on the right, there's crocodiles everywhere. Down on the left, there's hippos. Like just an amazing scenery. And then we drive forward and the driver starts freaking out and saying stuff. And I was like, what is it? Elephant walking right across the middle of the road and just walks across to the other side. And I was so mesmerized because I'm like, I never thought you'd see that. And I was expecting there to be safari tours going on and people taking photos. No, it's just in the middle of the street.
But it is a national park.
Yeah, it is a national park. So people go on those safari rides, but it was just amazing. I almost felt like it was better because it wasn't planned. It was just
Yeah, right, sure, definitely.
So we took that photo. And then the next one is kind of what you were talking about in the area that we were in. The border was there. Well, there's the photos that I got to hang out with the kids, which was, that's one of my favorite photos I think I'll probably ever take.
Amazing photo.
That kind of shows that just how curious these kids were. The little kid there, every time I like tear up when I see that little kid. Just so happy, man. And I showed him Snapchat, right? You know Snapchat where you can, basically, I don't know if you know it or use it, but you can put like filters on it. So it's like you hold up the phone and you can put like a filter, which is a dog ear filter, and it puts like dog ears on you. Uh-huh. And this kid was like looking behind my phone and like looking at my face. He thought that'd be, I was wearing a mask. And it was just amazing to see like how curious he was to this. And I was taking photos of him with the dog filters on and just kind of exploring it, which was one of the most amazing days, just experiencing that.
So let's go into, do you know that little boy? Did you spend any time with
him? I spent like 20 to 30 minutes at that point. That was during like a transition between areas that we were in really exploring. And he was a South Sudanese refugee. Mm-hmm. So he was in a,
Parents?
Never got to meet his parents. We don't know if he had parents at that point. There were, this was in, that point there was in a reception area, which is where refugees are taken to before they can be resettled. Okay. And they're just often taken on lists. And at that, and in those areas themselves, there was groups of like 800 to 1,000 people. And I think 75% of them are women and children. Because men are often taken or recruited or killed.
Or killed.
So it was a lot of them are women and children. But yeah, that was an amazing experience.
Well, if I've been done, not a refugee situation, but I've met little kids like that in very remote parts of Mexico. And ever since, I've always been dying to know whatever happened to some of those kids. You're probably going to feel that way about that little, you'll never know probably.
That's one of the harsh realities. And in one of the, in our video that's going to come out from it, there's two videos that's coming out. One which is going to be, both of them are going to be on the main show, I believe. One of them is more of a specific character study looking at a person. And it was a girl that I met there. And again, I don't want to spoil much of it, but I just pray for the best for that girl. Like she was just, she was 14 years of age. Mm. She loved football, which we immediately bonded over. And I mean, the situation that she'd been through was, you just couldn't even contemplate it. And that is what every day I think, like I talk to the people that I was there with and they're in contact and I just always check in. I'm like, how is she doing? Is she all right? Like, and it's, I don't know, it's like, it's almost, you almost feel like you just want to find out what goes on in her life moving through. But the reality is I'm not going to have a text message saying, oh, was she looking at colleges? Or is she going to do this? It's like, what's her future like? It's just, it's more of a preservation and hope that she finds a way to have a happier life in that area. So yeah, it does feel that, you do feel that way. You feel like you just want to keep informed in what's going on. And I never thought that I would leave that trip thinking, I'll go back. But I would absolutely go back because I want to see those people that I talked to. The last photo I wanted to show you, which is pretty interesting, that's the border.
Between
South Sudan and Uganda, right? And that bridge wasn't there. That's a lake in the middle. Mm-hmm. The Ugandan nationals built that bridge.
To help the refugees,
cross. Like, how much more symbolic could that be in comparison to what, of course, we see right here, where we're talking about walls being built. And that gentleman right there, his name was Sam. He was one of the police officials who were set to man that border point. Mm-hmm. And he basically said to us, we built that to basically make it easier. And one last point, which is, go back to the image really quick, Irma, just to show, is if you look to the right, you see that smoke area over there?
Yeah,
to the right? That's basically an area that's patrolled on the other side, which is by South Sudanese rebels. So we were not allowed, at one point we pointed at them and they did not take that very well because they don't want to be shown as they're on camera. It could risk their life, it could risk anything if they were seen helping refugees cross.
Right.
Because they're obviously in the middle of a war-torn area and they were armed to the teeth and they were not is welcoming. They didn't mind us filming anything there because obviously that's in Uganda. But if we went across there, Sam basically told us he couldn't do anything if they wanted to treat us, however, on that side.
Please, I hope you didn't have that sense of adventure.
I did not want to go across the other side of it. So yeah, if you see, and you see there, it was pretty green. Like it didn't look like a
desert.
It wasn't very. It wasn't like an area of famine. It seemed to me there was a lot of, and it rained every day we were there almost, at some point.
So
there's definitely a lot of green and growth around.
Well, you're probably going to do a lot when these get released next week, but we might have you back on the Friday postgame show.
Well, I'd love to
talk more openly and not be so nervous about whether I'm going to say something or ask something that I should or shouldn't.
But I'm excited to talk about what you've got.
Yeah, well, we'll do that again. So thanks. Then there's more to it. I don't even think we scratched the surface of what you experienced.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, the videos.
I want to know more about the people. So we talked about that one little boy and the 14-year-old girl, but there must be others who you've met.
Absolutely.
We're going to move on to two other events. And this one, my anticipation to talk about it has been growing and growing, which is another reason I want to get off Uganda and get to this obituary. So this is this week's edition of the obituaries. This is not, if there is a pattern of what I talk about, this would not be in that pattern. The subject here is Patricia Knatchbull, 93 years old, a pillar of Britain's elite. She's an English aristocrat. We're going to talk about her more. She, by the time I got to the end of this, she did, I think, absolutely nothing with her life. Did you get that sense too?
Yeah, it was more so running a very elitist circle.
So, she was born in 1924. She was third cousin to Elizabeth, who eventually became queen. Princess Elizabeth was eventually a maiden at her wedding.
Wow.
This woman, Patricia, was also first cousin to Prince Philip, who married Queen Elizabeth. But we all know how all these royalties are related. Mm-hmm. And she's great-great-grandchild of Queen Victoria. But of course, it's English royalty. They're all
connected
in some way. Her father was Lord Mountbatten, who was famous mostly for his assassination by the IRA. We're going to get to that in her life story because she was there. So this is, would you say that this is about as typical as English aristocrat or whatever the right term is as you can get? Like this would be
When you put that ancient artifact in front of me this morning and said I was going to talk about this, I was like, what is this thing?
Yeah, you got your hands dirty?
I got my hands dirty. I was like, there's ink on it. What's going on here?
We're so
dizzy. No, I don't know. My dad and everything still reads papers back home, so I'll take a glance when I go home. Every time you're so right in the way we talk a little bit off camera. It's like if someone's to put down a newspaper in front of us and say we're going to talk about this on the main show, you'd be like, wait, I can't just highlight a couple of sentences and get the general story and then look into some more research. So I actually, when I looked at it, I often get a little bit distracted at times when I'm reading newspapers now. But I was drawn into this story straight away. I'm very curious about the way that these elitist royalty members of English society and, of course, British society, is a whole bit mainly English, intermingle with each other and how they treat each other in a specific way based on titles that are often given to them because their third cousins was someone who was involved in a specific monumental moment throughout the war or anything else. And it took me back, I know this is moving into the modern day, but I actually think this show deserves a lot of credit, is The Crown is a show that I watched on Netflix. And historical accuracies aside, whether or not, it's a very interesting portrayal as to a lot of the unwritten rules that you have to abide by within when you're members of royalty or if you're in running that circle. Like the first thing to clarify when it comes to the royal family is they have no authorization over like parliamentary decisions. The only thing they have to do is they can put forward a mention, or we don't want Theresa May to be prime minister. Okay, we'll take that into consideration and then we'll meet the new prime minister. Like that's the only thing they have to be able to have some role of a government. But the way they're still treated and the way that when you look through the circles that they ran in, it's such a hierarchy that they're almost viewed as these untouchable elitist people that deserve everything that's been put in front of them. Their red carpet is rolled out to do whatever they want to do and is deserved in a way.
And these days, you can only speak for your own experiences. You don't have a full sociological profile. But what does the average working class or just middle class English, and we're talking about England mostly, yeah, here, English person think about these people these days? Do they still say, is there still a place in reserved for respect for these royal
I can't speak on behalf of like all of England, but from what I understand is there's still that sense of patriotism that's associated to the Queen and associated to the royal family. It's not shared when you go further north to Scotland, and it's not shared when you go towards Wales. But when you see the turnout for the Queen's birthday or the Golden Jubilee or the Silver Jubilee, like the amount of money that's spent on taxpayers' money to go into these just monumental parties that are thrown in the streets for the Queen or anything else. Yeah, there's still people that turn out in their numbers.
Like I get that.
That pay homage to the Queen.
I get that for the Queen and her children. But what about the third cousin of the Queen? Does anyone care about her?
The thing is, most people will often just see a title and they'll think that they're in some way involved. And I don't know if they would care so much about them in general. They wouldn't notice them in the streets. Not like they're portrayed as celebrities, but the story is interesting because you see the circles that they run in based on their family members and based on the connections that are often as far back as third or fourth cousins. They're still in a way connected to the goings on that happens in England.
So let's talk about this story. So she grew up without her, as the article, the obituary describes, her mother and father were just off doing whatever. They weren't even together.
Yeah,
they had their own love interests, their own life interests. And she was raised by nannies and governesses. And her mother just had a whole bunch of series of lovers until there was one who finally got along with the kids. And that was a big kind of surrogate dad in her life.
Yeah.
So, and at the same time, the father had a whole bunch of girlfriends. One of them ended up being the model for the character Gigi in the French novel written by Colette. It's a famous novel. I haven't read it, but now I know where it comes from anyway. And if I'm interested, maybe I'll read it. And during World War II, so they were living in England, which was not invaded. I mean, there was the air attack by Germany.
Yeah.
But she was, the article just says they were evacuated. They were evacuated by their families, right? They weren't evacuated by the government.
No,
they weren't in danger.
It was probably being put in like an area of protection because those were the most prized members within England that they had to be almost prioritized.
Were they?
Yeah, well, yeah. I'd imagine that would be the case. And I mean, I'm not speaking
I don't know about the word evacuate. I think her family just says, why don't you go to America while this terrible
while this thing's going on.
So she went to New York, but she didn't go live in some apartment on, you know, 37th Street. She was living with Grace Vanderbilt, the wife of Cornelius Vanderbilt III, who is one of the most famous families.
The name Vanderbilt carries, yeah.
Yeah. And they lived in a giant mansion and et cetera. And so she finally got married after World War II to a film producer who was well known. And his name was John Knatchbull. And that's why she's Patricia Knatchbull, even though she has a title, which we'll get to in a little while. So and then there isn't actually much about her after World War II until we get to the assassination of her grandfather. So her grandfather's Lord Mountbatten, who was the last British viceroy of India. And if you know anything about this and I say anything wrong, let me know.
No,
So he and his family, including Patricia, his granddaughter, were at their baronial mansion up near, you know, I guess it's in northern England, kind of near Ireland. No, it was in Ireland, right?
Where does it say that specific area was? I mean, if you're going northern, it'd be more towards Scotland.
Right. Let's see.
And it wouldn't be surprising because a lot of these very rich.
No, it's an Irish castle near Northern Ireland.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So it's a baronial holiday home. Did you have a baronial holiday home? No, I guess not.
Holiday homes are still not a thing wherever you come from. You have a home. And if you want to go on a holiday, I never get why anyone would have a holiday home in Britain. Like, you're supposed to go to an area that's sunny if you want a holiday home. So most people get them in Spain.
Before I go to their Irish baronial home, as you bring that up, she had, of course, many vacation homes in England, mansions all over the place because of who her family
was. That's a reminder of those parts of the, John, when you look at Queen Elizabeth's transition into power, as it was, they often had several locations in Scotland where they would often, if they wanted to get away from the press, they would flee to go and kind of be isolated from that central part of England where everyone watches, and it kind of was funny. It's like, oh, just send them to Scotland. No one will care about what they're doing in Scotland anyway. They'll go and see, have their own mansions. But,
and this is interesting, and I should have brought it up. After World War II, she went back to England, and she went to live in one of her Palladian mansions, but it had been partially converted into a hospital for injured soldiers. Mm. So, but that's what happened in England. That war was so devastating, and it consumed so much of the society that some of this royalty privilege had to be knocked down.
Yeah, it had to be
brought a little bit back toward Earth, and it happened after and during World War I, big time, and during World War II as well. So, that's part of the overall democratization of England. But anyway, they were in their holiday, their baronial holiday home in Ireland, near the border of Northern Ireland. And one morning, her grandfather, Lord Mountbatten, and she and her two teenage kids and a couple other people, boat hands and others, went out for a boat ride. And when they got away from the shore, turns out the IRA had planted a bomb in the boat and blew the crap out of it. It killed her grandfather, Lord Mountbatten. It killed one of the deckhands. It killed one of her twin children. Mm-hmm. This was in the early 70s, I believe. And she was blown into the air and survived, landed in the water. She had to stay in the hospital for many weeks afterwards getting treatment, but she survived. And I vaguely remember as a kid that assassination. I didn't know anything about it or who Lord Mountbatten was, some English guy, but...
It was a strategic attack on a title, which would hit, which in a way, of course, there was many attacks carried out during that era. This one is one of the most infamous because of the title.
One of the biggest hits that the IRA ever landed on English aristocracy or English society. Mm-hmm. So, and it was soon after that that she acquired her title of Lady
Mountbatten.
Like you said, not because she did anything, but just because of her grandfather and because to honor the fact that he was assassinated by the IRA, I guess.
Well, and it's kind of a theme through the whole article is like how much does it, it's not to demean like what she did in her life, but the idea of this article now is we don't really know. Like a lot of the references that they have is due to circumstances that happened in order to get her into a certain area of her life. Like there was no discussion of what was, you don't even see a part where they kind of tell us what she was like or what was going on with her life or what she was doing. It's almost like, okay, she married this guy, so then she got this title. And then this happened and this attack happened, so she moved into this title. And then she knew at the time King Edward and his social elite American wife, who then he actually left his position as a crown to be part of that circle. So that's how she moved into that area of her life. There was no real discussion
nothing about her as an individual. It's all about the circles you run in, the code of conduct that you have to live by.
Yeah.
So I thought this whole obit was interesting, fascinating.
Absolutely. That one specific example of how she befriended King Edward the I'm trying to believe. Is it that my knowledge is a little scarce as to?
Yeah, I don't know.
But it was at that point. It was the king who basically left his position.
I think it was the prince.
But at the time he was the king when he left. He basically left his throne
so that he could marry.
It was passed over to his brother, that's kind of where the story, the crown picks up. Most people will be like, oh, that's what happened in the Netflix show. But that was a big thing, obviously, at that time, because he went against the unwritten rules that he wasn't supposed to marry someone who had been previously married. That was that's something that it's almost suicidal in this royal environment that he was to choose love over his family or over royalty. Like he could not, that was an unforgivable sin, but based on reports and you look back, is that a lot of people in society actually favored his decision to pursue love. And he wasn't as excommunicated as it was portrayed by the royal family and those in that circle. Like you got to choose the title over everything else. You cannot choose to move away from that title. And that actually eventually became a theme as Queen Elizabeth's sister also was fell in love with one of the soldiers at that point who had previously been married. And she had a very similar scenario where the Queen Elizabeth had to basically choose to take her sister's side or choose to go with the roles that her family had driven into. No, she is not allowed to do this because, simply put, she cannot go with a man who is previously married. That's against this written, this unwritten rule in the royal families. You have to stay true to this, these rules that are set forth
right.
for you.
And so the king who abdicated is King Edward VIII.
King Edward VIII, yes. That was it,
and
yeah.
He married Wallace Simpson, and that was huge back in those days. I would have said, why do I care about that? And now I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
And by the way, this Patricia Mountbatten, became later Patricia Knatchbull, her eldest son, this doesn't stop. He inherited the title Earl Mountbatten of Burma. Why you would want to be the Earl of Burma, or why English has even the England has the right to give you the title Earl of Burma? I don't know. I don't get it. But this goes on and on. Although with each passing year, each passing decade, this royal family diminishes, and their I suppose their influence and the intrigue that the people have for them diminishes.
Do you think so?
I don't know. I mean, well, I know that the world wars, as we just discussed, knocked it down many pegs.
Well, I mean, due to the fascination that. In America, there's this fascination with the royal family. Like people are, like even my own girlfriend just wants to be everything like Kate Middleton. It's like because there's still that status. There's still that obviously the title that comes along with it. But it's this, like you have your celebrities and you have everything that people want to emulate and they want to be like that. But then it seems like the royal family is just put on a different level. Untouchable. You cannot attain that. So it's the highest status. And obviously, I try my best to bring my girlfriend back down to earth and give them an outlook as to what I think of the royal family. Now, the thing about me with the royal family is I just don't care. Like, I just don't think they do anything. Like,
right,
I think they stand as a tourist attraction. That's my ultimate opinion of them. Like, they're given all this wealth, all this, almost a false sense of power just because they were born into a family that at one point in time had control. So I think nowadays, I don't think the respect that is had for the royal family is diminishing. I think it's just taking new forms as people are now fascinated with what they do in the social circles. Like they're fascinated on who Prince
Harry
is dating and who he's going to bring into the royal family. It's almost like a game of like,
sure.
If you put, I wouldn't be surprised if they turned it into Bachelorette season to become the new princess. Like that would probably be one of the most watched shows.
I don't think
Elizabeth
would like that.
Yeah, well, depends how long she's.
And Kate Middleton's become a baby factory. Is your girlfriend into that aspect too? Is that what she wants?
I don't know, man. I hope not. I hope that's not a sign that she's portraying. I think she likes her fashion sense, and I mean, you just think about it. But like, imagine this is it's probably a very similar way that Princess Elizabeth was treated at that point. I know that was a big thing when she married Prince Philip, who was in a very admired man at that point, and there probably was a very same fascination with them, just not as social. People were probably just talking about it rather than sharing photos every 5 minutes and Snapchats about what Kate Middleton and the Prince are doing around their travels. So I almost feel like it's just taking new forms. They're still fascinated. They'll always be fascinated.
Yeah, but we got to get off the English royalty and get on to this guy. So this is from Inc. magazine and INC. And the author interviewed this Bolivian student at UCLA who's either about to or just graduated. The headline teases you by saying he plans to become president of Bolivia, but that's kind of nonsense. He's 21. Maybe he does plan, but that's not what the article is about. He's a young entrepreneur. And even though he's in college, he and his friends made some companies, including one that created a tech gadget to charge your cell phone. Mm-hmm. And I just want to talk about some of the philosophy. This guy's 21 years old and he already has his ways, his thoughts. I mean, Cenk would love this guy. So he's one of these guys who wants to devote himself to business, it seems. So I don't know why he wants to become president of Bolivia. Well, we'll get to that. But he has this rule that he tries to eat lunch with a different person every day because he wants to learn a little bit from each one of them. By the way, it's a good rule. I'm not going to make fun of him, but I try to do it. Like this year, I resolved that I wanted to have lunch with more of the people at TYT. And I've had like four of them, and it's June because I'm one too of damn busy. How does this guy? He's a student at UCLA and running a comedy, and he has to have lunch with a different person every day. I think it's funny. I think it's admirable. I don't know how if he gets that record. You know, if he achieves that.
It's a very admirable ideology. Whether he's able to execute it with his busy schedule, I mean. I don't know, like maybe at college he has the more accessible means to go and pursue it because UCLA I know is a very diverse campus and maybe he just, everyone between classes, he might have the ability, like everyone's on lunch at that point. If you're trying to do it in a workplace, some people are working on when you're having your lunch or some people are, it's a little harder.
But that's because once you're working, you're a slave to your job. So when you're, if you're not working yet, if you're young in college or whatever, or haven't started your working life yet, man, take advantage of that and go free and be free and break all the rules and try to live outside of the confines that society puts on you. Because, yeah, I can't even go and have lunches on a regular basis with people who I've barely ever talked to who work here at TYT.
Yeah.
This guy, and here's where he goes too far. He's so business-minded. He breaks people down into three categories. He likes to have lunch or keep in his network people, number one, people who are 10 to 100 times ahead of him, whatever that means, so he can learn from them. Then he wants people at his own level because he wants to compete with them. And then he, part of his network is people who are below, haven't really gotten started with life. By the way, this kid's 21, hasn't graduated college yet. He's got people who haven't started life. What has he started? And he wants people who haven't gotten started in life yet so he can help them. So again, very admirable. But man, when you're starting to analyze your social life like that and breaking it down into, I want the 10 to 100 times better than me. I want my competitors. I want the people lower than me. I'm not so comfortable with that.
Do you not feel like that's, I mean, he's kind of just playing into a breaking down mechanism that I think is probably engraved in a lot of people in America, first of all. Like you, this high school friend group that you often bring around you, you've probably got, if you're a jock, then you're probably friends with everyone who's on the same field as you, who's friends with you. You're probably friends with people who are much smarter than you because you need their help when it comes to homework. And then you're probably friends with people that you think are below you because you want to feel good about yourself. And you want to feel like that's around. So I almost feel like, yeah, it's not the best. I don't
He's just codifying it.
He's just kind of quantifying it based on a business idea that he's going to have people who, I mean, how he's rating these people, I don't imagine is a good way to interact in society. But he's
That's right.
I try to approach things in a similar outlook, not putting people in a scale. I just think I will never surround myself with people who I think are below me because it's just a douchey thing to even say. But I always try to find people around me that I think are a couple of steps ahead and are doing things that I would like to try and admire to do.
And that's great. But right, when you codify it and quantify it and you meet someone and you're immediately thinking, is that guy in the 10 times we category or is my
What category am I in right now? And that's you're already analyzing yourself when you're meeting them. You want to bring a presentation to the lunch with the guy just to try and justify yourself to be in a higher
percentage. I don't want to crap all over this guy. By the way, his name is Alejandro Rioja or Riojo.
I'm so glad you named
Alejandro Rioja.
I would not ever have crucified that.
He's a real entrepreneurial. So he came up with this gadget, this charge cell phones that's better than what's out there. But they didn't have a lot of marketing. So he and his buddies would just go to the Santa Monica 3rd Street Promenade and just start selling them to people. And it kind of worked. They caught on. And now he has a whole bunch of little companies.
That's good.
So I do admire him doing this.
He's definitely intuitive.
And he came from Bolivia, and one of the questions a reporter asked him is, why'd you bother going to college? Everyone knows that entrepreneurs don't need to go to college. You just need to make your business. But he's an open-minded guy. He knows that in college you're going to get new experiences and learn things and meet people, and it's going to help him. It's going to make him a better person.
Well, I definitely like, so the first part about it, trying to have lunch with different people, I think it's essential into trying to understand, especially in America, trying to understand different cultures to break down negative stereotypes. I wish, now that I've graduated and been out of college for 3 years now, I wish I could have took advantage more so of the situation and surrounding that I was in. I was in a liberal arts college, so there was a lot of diversity, but there was also a lot of very left skewed politics. I actually think I would have been more benefit for my job right now if I talked and had a lot more conservative conversations with conservative professors, if there was any on my campus about it, or there was other people that were leaning that way, because I think it would allow me to have more of a broader outlook on politics today and not be so cynical when it comes to a different view on politics, which I think is a problem in this country. It happens. But I think that he might not have the best objective in the end by trying to have a, maybe he's constantly treating everything as a business transaction, which I'm not for, because I think, especially in Los Angeles, in the field that we're in, you meet someone when you're out at a party or a social event, everyone's trying to sell themselves or trying to sell you something. Like, they're almost like everything's treated like an audition or an interview. And I think that kind of takes away from just the trying to find out about someone else. So yeah. I hope that he's not treating it that way, and I hope that he's just trying to identify
different cultures.
Yeah, I
hope that, because this is a business magazine, that the article, the author is making it sound more businessy than it really is, and that's possible. So he wants to become president of Bolivia to help, basically, for the reason anyone who with a good heart wants to be president of any, to help the underprivileged, because Bolivia has a high mm-hmm. percentage of impoverished people. So he's saddened by that. He comes from Bolivia, and he knows that part of his country. So he wants to be president to help, and that's great. I mean, who knows if he's going to become president? That would probably be 20, 30 years, 40 years from now, if it ever happens.
Well, if he wants to learn how to become a politician, then he needs to immediately start. He's on the right path. He's breaking down people based on their
sure.
whether they're below him. So maybe he'll spend just 5 minutes with them, and then he'll spend 10 minutes with the people that's with him, and then he'll spend
more
45 to 50 minutes with the people that are above him.
Give him money for his campaigns. Yeah. But in Bolivia or in Latin America, if you're a businessman, that is a good way to get into politics.
Yeah.
In the U.S., it never was until 2016.
Yeah.
but the president of Argentina now is a businessman, although he's just the son of a businessman. I don't know.
Every time we talk about when me and you have a conversation, I feel like we do find a way into Latin American politics at some point, because I think we both share a mutual interest of it that I would love if we were able to discuss more so on.
I would love it too, but it's hard to get good journalism out of it. That's the advantage. That's why you can have a talk show in America, because there's so much information. But
yeah.
It's hard in these Latin American countries. They don't have the developed, mature institutions that we have. You can talk about Latin American politics, but it's all about just power plays and who you know and corruption. And
I don't know if it's, I mean, there's so much history in politics that there is plenty of examples to choose from. I just find Latin American politics and the history of it the most fascinating, I think, in the involvement of the U.S. more so in Latin American politics. I find, for me,
I
studied it, more interesting and fascinating than even U.S. involvement in the Middle East and even U.S. involvement in Europe and different. I just find it so, every time I read up on it, I'm never left like unintrigued. I just always find there's something else to discuss. And that was at a full class in college. It was called Latin American Politics and American Influence. And it was a great class, man. And it was just mm-hmm. constantly looking into Pinochet's regime and just looking into different changes in the involvement of the U.S. and whenever I can find time to just identify more about it, I can spend hours watching it.
Well, I can give you, I didn't do it on these post-game shows, but Manuel Noriega, former dictator of Panama, died recently. And I could have covered him. But his life story is a microcosm and encapsulation of U.S. involvement for the better and for the worse in Latin America. In most cases, for the worse in his case. Because he was both an ally and then later an enemy of the United States. So it's an interesting little story. And eventually we deposed him in a military action, and he died as a crumpled old man either at his home or in a hospital in Panama. But
there's a lot that's open to discussion, especially. That's why whenever we do a clip, often at times it's always in the back of my head. Like we did a clip on the main show, I think, couple of months ago, and it was talking about Argentinian politics. And I believe there was some protests. And I don't know who was on the panel. I'm not throwing anyone under the bus. But there was just an overall, like, fluffy outlook on it. It was just like, oh, yeah, like, look at what happens in the political system right there. Like, this is crazy. You're not even allowed to protest, right, without, like, a risk or something. And I think we focused on another one in Chile. And I was just like, man, like, look back in the history and the involvement of the United States in a lot of these places. Now, that's not to blame. I'm just saying that, like, there's a lot of U.S. influence that's led to these countries taking the shape and form that they have today. And although it's not, people might not think it's directly responsible, and I'd never want to assume that, it's just, I feel like there needs to be an overall, more of a knowledgeable approach to what Latin American politics has meant in regards to the US's foreign relations and how they often at times tested out certain foreign policy in Latin American politics and looked to try and establish certain rules there. And you see it taking some forms and some shapes today in different foreign policy areas. And I think it's just so fascinating that spend some time looking into it.
Yeah, well, I try to do a little bit on the post-game show. I don't get into the history so much because that's out there already. You can read many books on that matter.
Yeah.
But of course, everyone knows that I want a little more of a Latin America focus when I do things just because I like it.
Yeah.
So that's our 3-part post-game today. Thanks for joining us.
Of course.
We'll probably have to have you back to talk about more about Uganda after everything's released.
I would love to. It will be more of a free-flowing,
you won't be worried in the back of your mind. Should I say that?
We could probably use video as well. I can only describe what I've experienced, but it's much easier to see what I experienced.
All right. Well, thank you, Francis, and thank you to the members for supporting TYT. And the Friday gang, without me, will be back next week.
Oh,
bye-bye.
Good.